It's Thursday, March 6, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On Tuesday, President Barack Obama unfurled his budget for the coming governmental budget year beginning on October the 1st. It's a whopping $3.9 trillion budget, and politically speaking, it's dead on arrival at the United States Congress. But the purpose of the budget, as released by the White House on Tuesday, really wasn't about a budget. It really wasn't about the economy, or for that matter, even about federal spending. It was about the upcoming 2014 elections, and the budget that was released by the White House is actually more of a campaign document than it is a budget. What we need to look at from a worldview perspective is what a budget is supposed to be. A budget for a family, for an individual, for an organization, or a congregation, or for a government, is a statement of intention and it is a profound statement of values. From a worldview perspective, when you're looking at the decisions that go into making a budget, you're looking at the decisions about investment. You're looking at policies and principles when it comes to the handling of money. You're looking at the balancing of opportunities of spending and savings and indebtedness. And when you look at the budget of the United States of America, most citizens recognize we're looking at a train wreck about to happen. That is clear in President Obama's budget. As he makes clear within the minutiae of his budget, at present, over two-thirds of the federal government spending is in entitlement programs, and that's before you get to anything else that most people think the government is actually paying for, including the military and other forms of national spending. If this remains unchecked, and the president's budget not only leaves it unchecked but continues to exaggerate the problem, the federal budget will find that 80% of the entire federal budget and its expenditures will be related to entitlement programs going to individuals. That raises a host of issues. President Obama, in speaking about his budget, or this campaign document called a budget, said that a budget is a profound statement of our values. In the president's own words, quote, "Our budget is about choices. It's about our values," end quote. That is undeniably true, of course, but there's also much more to a budget. A budget is also a statement about reality. President Obama's budget assumes an annual growth in gross domestic product of 3.3%. That might not sound like much, but that's far more growth than the United States economy has experienced in recent years. And even some economists inside the president's own party are very doubtful that a continued growth of 3.3% will happen. If that does not happen, not only will the deficit not be paid down, but it will continue to grow. And we're looking at the absolute train wreck that is coming of entitlement spending that has no controls on it. We are borrowing money right now to pay benefits to ourselves, that is to our citizens, that future generations are going to have to pay for. At the very same time, the growth rate indicates that there are going to be fewer younger workers and more older workers retiring and going on to these entitlement programs at increased rates of payment. You don't have to be a math whiz to understand that that's a disaster in the making. As a matter of fact, it's a disaster in the present. Even in the present, we're not paying our bills. We're charging those bills in advance to future generations. And what we're looking at in terms of President Obama's budget is a nonsensical document. And yet, before we jump too hard on President Obama, in an election year, both parties generally put forward budgets that are intended more to be about statements of how to increase their base and voter turnout, not so much about the realities of the budget. But President Obama's proposed budget is particularly nonsensical and irresponsible in this account because it adds to the problem. It even removes some of the proposals that President Obama had made in previous years about some modest decreases in the increased rate of spending for entitlements. All that's gone by the way in terms of this budget, which is really aimed, as everyone recognizes, at the 2014 elections. Jackie Calmes, writing on the front page of the New York Times, makes that point very clear. Quote, "President Obama sent Congress a $3.9 trillion budget request that stands as a platform for Democrats to run on this election year, full of policies intended to invite contrast with Republicans rather than offer compromises as he did last year without success," end quote. The paper goes on to say that the president's budget for the 2015 fiscal year, quote, "reflects his aspirations in his waning presidency, regardless of the political reality he confronts. The document, his sixth budget, seeks to energize Democratic voters with populist proposals like a more generous tax cut for the working poor, paid for with higher taxes on the rich," end quote. The chairman of the House Budget Committee, Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, said, quote, "This budget isn't a serious document. It's a campaign brochure," end quote. Well, as we've noted, the budgets presented by both political parties in an election cycle are generally just that. Campaign documents. This budget is particularly irrelevant also because Congress has passed a two-year spending plan that means that there is no way that this budget is probably even going to be discussed in terms of real legislation in the current Congress. In its editorial on the White House budget, USA Today declared, quote, "Just when smaller deficits should make it easier to reach the sort of bipartisan deal that could solve the government's budget problems for a generation, President Obama and Congress are walking away from the job," end quote. The responsibility of the president is to produce a budget, and this budget is a disappointment not only to the editors of USA Today, but to anyone who believes in fiscal responsibility. The editors of USA Today get right to the heart of the issue when they write, quote, "The next generation had better get ready. Obama's third-to-last budget is essentially a campaign document that defines Democratic priorities in an election year. For instance, it increases aid to the working poor and pays for it by stripping away tax breaks from hedge fund managers and independent professionals that are defended by Republicans," end quote. The paper then concludes, "Slashing the popular entitlements is political poison, as is asking people to pay for them. But this obviously can't go on forever, fanciful budgets notwithstanding," end quote. That's a very strong statement. It's apt and it's accurate. This budget is irresponsible, and so is the discussion taking place in Congress, especially in the cycle of an election year. The president bears full culpability and responsibility for this very irresponsible budget. Congress bears a good sense of responsibility and a good share of the culpability as well. But the biggest problem isn't with Congress or with the president of the United States. It isn't with Democrats or Republicans. It's with the American people. Because it's the American people who now find themselves funded by so many entitlement programs that voters are essentially voting themselves benefits while refusing to vote for higher taxes and other forms of revenue that would pay for those benefits. We're charging them to our children. That is profoundly wrong. It is immoral. It is unrighteous. It is unjust. And what we have right now is a political breakdown that doesn't end in Congress, nor does it land entirely at the White House. It is ultimately our responsibility. In a democratic system of government, we are the people. We are the government. We elect those leaders, and we refuse to hold them accountable because, quite honestly, we do not want to hold ourselves accountable. Once again, President Obama made a very sensical statement within his nonsensical budget. He said, and I quote again, "Our budget is about choices. It's about our values," end quote. Well, this budget and our current budget and the budgets in foreseeable future years, at least in terms of the political reality of the present, indicate that we're making poor choices, and we have very inferior values, values that are allowing us to rob from our own children and future grandchildren. Shifting to the issue of political responsibility and the issue of same-sex marriage, Joseph Girth, a columnist for the Louisville Courier-Journal, writing over the weekend, addressed the fact that the Democratic Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Kentucky was going to have to make a very difficult decision. That decision was whether or not, as Attorney General of the state, to defend the state's constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage after a federal judge in Louisville struck down key provisions of that constitutional amendment and declared that same-sex marriages performed in other states must be recognized in Kentucky. But as U.S. District Court Judge John Hayburn made very clear in handing down that decision, it's really not just about same-sex marriages performed outside the state of Kentucky. The federal judge basically invited plaintiffs to bring a challenge to the entire constitutional amendment in Kentucky, and in just a matter of days, those plaintiffs appeared, and that case is now pending before the very same court and the same judge. In reality, the decision that the Attorney General of Kentucky faced is whether or not to defend the entirety of the state's constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. In that sense, Kentucky's Attorney General found himself in a genuine political quandary. After all, he was going to disappoint someone, and he was going to make his decision after six Democratic attorneys general in respective states decided that they would not defend the Constitution or the laws of their state in the federal courts, a very radical position in itself. As Joseph Girth wrote, quote, "No matter what Conway decides, he'll surely anger a sizable portion of Kentucky's electorate. One, a group that could make it tough to win a Democratic primary for governor, and the other, a group that could make it difficult to win the general election. As is well known, the Kentucky Attorney General, Jack Conway, is expected to be the front runner to replace the current Democratic governor of Kentucky, Stephen Beshear, coming up in 2015. In other words, the Attorney General of Kentucky had his own political future very much in view, as he knew he had to make this decision. But he did make the decision. And earlier this week, the Kentucky Attorney General indicated that he would not defend the Kentucky Constitutional Amendment, and that means the Kentucky Constitution, in the federal courts. In an apparently emotional public statement, the Attorney General made very clear that he believed that Judge Haburn had ruled rightly and that Kentucky's constitutional amendment was discriminatory. He said that he would not side with prejudice and thus would not defend the constitutional amendment. That's a very risky step to take in Kentucky, but the Attorney General must have believed that he was making the step, taking less risk than he would have taken if he had defended the constitutional amendment. In making his statement during his public appearance, Mr. Conway said, quote, "In the final analysis, I had to make a decision I could be proud of, for me now and for my daughter's judgment in the future," end quote. That's a very revealing statement. Here you have the Attorney General of Kentucky stating very clearly that he wanted to make a decision that would be well viewed by others later, not just in the present, but especially later. He spoke very openly of his concern to earn the admiration of his own daughters, who, once they are grown, would have to live with the fact that their father had made this decision. What we have here is an arc of history argument, a progressivist understanding of history that suggests that an unfolding of these rights is inevitable, and those who want to be seen on the right side of history simply have to get with the program and support the legalization of same-sex marriage. By the way, the governor of Kentucky, Stephen Beshear, announced that he would, on behalf of the state, hire an independent attorney to defend the constitutional amendment in the federal courts. But the Democratic governor doesn't intend to go too far in terms of that defense of the state's constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage. He seemed to be indicating that he wanted to buy time for an orderly transition to legal same-sex marriage within the Commonwealth of Kentucky. So, again, Jack Conway becomes the seventh Attorney General, the seventh Democratic Attorney General in the United States, to publicly announce that he would not defend the Constitution of his state, something that by his very oath of office he had sworn to do. But in this case, as we've discussed in recent days, he was simply following the advice of the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, who very publicly made the same argument, giving that very advice to the Attorneys General of the respective states. A radical statement in and of itself. But while we're looking at the Democratic side, we do need to recognize that this political balance sheet is very unbalanced. The Democrats are, by and large, the great defenders of legalized same-sex marriage. The head of the Democratic Party, that is, its chief highest elected officer, would be President Obama, who in 2012 openly campaigned for office as a supporter of same-sex marriage, something that he had opposed when he ran for president the first time in 2008. The Democratic Party put that support in terms of its political platform for 2012, and the party is very well situated on the issue, very publicly in support of the legalization of same-sex marriage coast to coast. But what about the Republicans? In 2012, the Republican Party put in opposition to the legalization of same-sex marriage in its political platform. But those who might believe that the Republican Party will stand firm on the issue should consider the March 4 edition of the New York Times and this headline, "Republicans from West Join Action on Marriage." Eric Eckholm reports, "Evoking Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater, a group of Western state Republicans plans to enter the battle in favor of same-sex marriage on Tuesday, urging a federal appeals court to declare gay marriage bans in Utah and Oklahoma unconstitutional." Eckholm goes on to report, "The most prominent of the approximately 20 signers of the brief are former Senator Alan K. Simpson of Wyoming, a longtime supporter of gay rights, and former Senator Nancy L. Kassebaum of Kansas, who said last year that she had reconsidered her former opposition to same-sex marriage. The document that was signed by these prominent Republicans says, quote, "Marriage is strengthened and the social stability of the family unit are promoted," end quote, by allowing gay and lesbian couples to legally wed. Remember also that when the controversy erupted in recent days about proposed religious liberty legislation in the state of Arizona, prominent Republicans, including the last two Republican presidential nominees, Senator John McCain and former Governor Mitt Romney, both came out against the legislation, calling on the Republican governor of Arizona to veto the legislation, which she did. The 2012 presidential election pitted the two parties against one another on a very clear issue of contrast on the issue of abortion and on the issue of same-sex marriage. But the 2012 presidential election is almost certainly to be the last national political contest in which those lines will be so clear. You can count on the fact that increasing numbers of prominent Republicans are going to be shifting their position on this very quickly if they have not already. From a Christian worldview perspective, we have to remember that in a fallen world, politics is never pretty. And it's especially not pretty when it comes to the fact that political pressures like this, the larger cultural and moral revolution on the issue of sexuality and homosexuality in particular, will lead to almost predictable changes in position when a certain momentum has been reached, when the velocity of change in a moral revolution has reached a certain speed and a certain certainty, an inevitability in the minds of politicians. Remember, and the Christian worldview in terms of its understanding of sinfulness affirms this and makes it very clear that political parties exist to gain power and to keep power. And they will basically do almost anything in order to gain seats, gain offices, gain power, gain cultural influence, and then maintain those ultimate political goods. And as Christians are looking at this particular question, looking at the developments that are now trumpeted in terms of this kind of headline in the New York Times, we need to recognize that what we're being told here is that politicians generally will act like politicians. Most importantly, when you collect them together in political parties will do, in the end, generally speaking, whatever the party believes is in its best interest. Now that the effort to legalize same-sex marriage has reached this velocity, both in terms of politics and judicial decisions and the larger understanding of the American people, influenced by popular culture and this moral revolution, you can count on the political parties quickly coalescing around some new consensus. You can see it when you look at the Democratic attorneys general in the states. You can see it in so many cases when you look at prominent Republicans, especially in the West, greatly influenced by the libertarian position in the Republican Party. But you can also see it and you can sense it in terms of how the parties will respond to this in now rather predictable patterns. Even now, you can imagine the kind of advice that political strategists and consultants are giving to the political parties in general and to the Republicans specifically. If you want to win, you're going to have to get with the program. The Democrats got with the program. Now the Republicans will have to sing the same song and be absolutely making the same arguments, or they're going to be left behind by history. You can imagine that these arguments are being made. And if your sole concern is to be elected to office and to maintain political influence and authority, well, that advice is going to look pretty sound. That's the sad reality of politics. And yet, politics remains very important. After all, it is in the political process that laws are made and great moral signals are sent to the entire civilization, to the culture at large. Politics matters, but there are things that matter far more than politics. And in the course of this debate and this discussion, within the larger culture and now within the Republican Party, in short order, we're going to find out where the conviction politicians are and where the simple political politicians are. We're going to find out whether some of those who oppose same-sex marriage did so out of conviction or just out of political pressure when it was popular. We're going to find out these things pretty quickly. We need also to realize that Christians operating on the basis of the Christian worldview will find themselves in positions where we can certainly be very disappointed. But at the same time, if we understand what politics is all about and we're operating out of the Christian worldview informed by Scripture, we may be disappointed, we're likely to be, but we better not be shocked. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll be speaking today at the Shepherd's Conference at Grace Community Church in Sun Valley, California. At 2 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I'll be giving an address on homosexuality and the gospel. At 7 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I'll be preaching on Romans chapter 1, verses 16 through 32, a message entitled, Suppressing the Truth in Unrighteousness. The Gospel of Christ Confronts the Conspiracy of the Ages. I'll hope perhaps to see some of you there. If you can't attend, it is visible by streaming video at the website for the Shepherds Conference, shepherdsconference.org. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, California, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.